Richard says when we go to play golf, prepare to be amazed. not so much for my answers, but for the incredible range of questions that I have received. So thank you to those who submitted questions for today's Ask the Minister. So I'm just going to move right along since there are... Aw, Gracie, honey. Bye. So I'm just going to address these in the order that I received them. So the first question, this came from an anonymous source. Why do some religions believe you will go to hell if not saved? So what I would first say is that it doesn't seem to me that there are a variety of religions that teach that as much as there are a variety of denominations that teach that. So that seems to be central to traditional Christianity. And I think the important thing to remember, for us to know especially, is that Jesus did not teach this. He did not talk about eternal damnation or torment. He actually wasn't concerned about the afterlife. His focus and his teachings and his message was on how to live in this life. So he didn't speak about the concept of hell. Rather, after death, he just talked about basically being dead, being not, you know, not present, or annihilated, we might say. Then the Apostle Paul came along and taught the idea of Jesus having died for our sins, so to speak, and believed in a sense of salvation, but that salvation would come during the rapture or the resurrection. So this was a way of being in good graces so that when that occurred, you would be among those who were saved. But over time, it began to, the original teachings of Jesus, and then they morphed through the Apostle Paul. And then as it began to merge with pagan philosophy, then some of these ideas that had originated with Plato and just sort of pagan philosophy started getting merged in there about an afterlife. And then the real articulation of the idea of hell gained a lot of ground with Augustine in the 4th century. So when the church was being formally created as an institution, then all these different ideas started being adopted as part of Orthodox Christianity, not the only Christianity, but that is really where it started to take root. Overall, if you look at history, it seemed that people needed some concept of divine justice. So this idea of there being a heaven or hell after death caught on because people felt like if you led a good life, if you're a great person, a holy person, you should be rewarded. If, on the other hand, you did evil deeds, you mistreated people, there should ultimately be some kind of punishment for that. But ultimately, hell became so central to traditional Christianity that some have said that it is most essentially a hell avoidance plan. So in Unity, we teach heaven and hell as states of consciousness, not as destinations in the afterlife. Second question, do you have any hope that the different parts and pieces of the Unity Church School campus will ever unite as one? So some of you may not realize there are 2 Unity headquarters organizations. One is Unity Worldwide Ministries, and that is the body that represents the churches, basically. So that's a member-driven, member-constituted organization, and that exists separately. It's relatively small. The other organization is Unity World Headquarters at Unity Village that oversees the Daily Word, Silent Unity, all those wonderful blessing booklets that we get, retreats, some of the activities at Unity Village. So when I worked at Unity Village, there was quite a movement afoot to merge these 2 organizations and have what we call the Unity in Unity, which sounds great, does it not? Like, hello. But anyway, so we created the branding program. We created one merged website, unity.org. There was a lot of momentum in that direction. And then what happened is they realized the organizational structures were so different because one is a member-led organization, the other is its own nonprofit that serves not only people in Unity, or Unitics, as we're sometimes called, but also people of other denominations and even faiths around the world. So it's been very difficult to figure out how to combine them. I hold in my heart the possibility that it can still happen. Is this next question? Oh, that question was from Paul Mitchum, by the way. Thank you, Paul. And this next one is also from Paul. He says, how much faith does it take to believe in God? Well, Jesus would say only as much as a mustard seed, right? It doesn't take much. But then, you know, how do you really measure faith, right? I mean, how do you even measure it? In my mind, faith is basically a choice. It's a choice of whether you choose to believe only in what you see in front of your face and these current circumstances, or whether you believe in a higher order of things of which you are a part that is constantly unfolding in the direction of a higher good. So faith in God sometimes means faith that, you know, sort of more traditionally, that there's an outer God out here, like a super being in the sky, you're going to appeal to make everything right in your life or in the world. We don't teach that kind of faith. We teach more faith in God as principle and God as beingness that it, in its essence, is good. To me, the most important question isn't even how much faith you have. It's whether you have faith when you need it. Right? Are you able to look beyond temporary appearances to higher principles of truth and sort of trust that all is unfolding for your highest good? And just remember that God is in you. So when you have faith in yourself, you are also having faith in God. Paul's next question. Love you, Paul. Will Christians attain higher consciousness if we start viewing Jesus as a human being equal to all other humans and stop elevating Jesus to God-like hybrid being? So this is a really interesting question. You know, in Unity, we teach essentially that we're all hybrid beings, right? Because we're spiritual beings having a human experience. So that hybrid being is kind of the direction we want to go in terms of our understanding not only of Jesus, but also of ourselves. Now, if your question is, would we make more progress if we took Jesus off the pedestal of being God or being something we can never aspire to? In other words, if we stop thinking of Jesus as the great exception, but rather think of him as the great example for us, I think that makes a tremendous difference. But what's happened over history is that people have spent so much energy trying to determine the nature of Jesus. Was he divine? Was he human? Was he both? That quite often we've been focusing on, you know how they say the finger pointing to the moon, right? The person pointing to truth. We focus so much on the person that we've been missing the truth that he was pointing to. And so I think that is the most salient question about how we should relate to Jesus, is to look to the truth that he was pointing to. And the truth that we believe more than any that he was pointing to is that what he did, we could do too, and greater things still. So he wanted us to know our own innate power and potential. So this one is from Dean. Wonderful Dean Ratzliff. What is the kingdom of heaven Jesus talks about? Is it always near or just sometimes? So you know that Jesus spoke about the kingdom of heaven probably as much or more than anything else. 15 of his parables are directly concerned with the kingdom of God. And in Matthew alone, 12 of his parables are introduced with the expression, the kingdom of heaven is like. So kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God, were used sort of interchangeably. So the Jewish people who were oppressed during his time had a sense of a Messiah who would come and restore their rightful places, the chosen people, with their own land. So when he spoke about a kingdom of heaven, that's what they were envisioning, that this would be an earthly kingdom, kind of a new political order. So that's how they thought about what he was saying. But Jesus made it clear he was not talking about an earthly kingdom. he was talking about a shift in consciousness. It was not of this world. Remember, he said the kingdom of heaven is within you, right? It's not here, it's not there. Don't look here, don't look there. The kingdom already is here within you and all about you. So in unity, we teach that the kingdom of heaven is a state of consciousness. So you, I'm sure, have had heavenly states of consciousness in your life. You've probably had states of not such heavenly consciousness as well. The distinguishing trait here for, I believe, having a heavenly state of consciousness is when you are in unitive consciousness. In other words, when you know the truth of oneness. So what keeps us from being in a heavenly, in the kingdom of heaven, let's say, is that we believe in the illusion of separation. We believe that we are separate from one another and that we are separate from God. And that sets up all the ego battles, that sets up the we, they, you know, the stories, all the stuff that we create. But those moments, just think about it in your own life, those moments that you would describe as heavenly, did you not have an experience of oneness? Did you not have a sense of being connected to all that is? Well, that's really what, at least in unity, we equate with the kingdom of heaven. It's like the veil is lifted, right? Even in times of catastrophe or disaster, haven't you found that all the outer differences disappear and suddenly we're human being to human being, just trying to help one another and be there for each other? Jesus taught that the kingdom of heaven had not fully arrived, so it was understood as both a present and a future reality. We would say that it is always here. To your question, is it just sometimes near or not always? Is that it is always here in pure potential. In other words, you always have, in any given second, you have that potential to shift your awareness to really, we might say, see through the eyes of God, and it kind of anthropomorphizes God, but you know what I'm saying? To see through the eyes of love, to see through the eyes of oneness, and experience that shift of consciousness. When we don't do that. And in that state of consciousness, God is known to be the only reality, the one power, the one presence that is all. That's really why, that's why we're called unity, because that is the paramount understanding. Dean's next question gave me so many great questions, Dean. Thank you. What is the goal of following Jesus? How do we do it? I've always found his teachings to be difficult to follow. Not like the Buddhist teachings that give an eight-step path and four noble truths. But then I learned about the eight-bough tree that Mary Magdalene saw in a vision. So what is the goal of following Jesus? To attain his level of consciousness. It is truly about consciousness. In unity, we teach that that was the purpose of his ministry, to shift consciousness, to, we might say, raise consciousness, so that we would be able to grow into our full divine potential. So our relationship with him, so it isn't formulaic, like do these 10 things, do these 8 things, and you will get there, because it's more of a shift of consciousness is internal work. It's seeing differently. It's perceiving truth. So remember, we're not so much trying to win Jesus' favor, we're not worshiping him, but we're trying to emulate what he showed us, not only through his teachings, but through his example. And in terms of how to follow him, honestly, Dean, what I think about more than anything is the first two commandments. You know, just to take into my own heart, love God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. You know, that's plenty right there. Just imagining if we could really take that to heart in this world or in our own lives and live true to that, because I do believe his ministry was about love. And so how to follow him is to internalize that and make it your own internal operating system, if you will, and to strive to express that in everything you do and every way you interact with others. The question is whether we can get past our egos to do that. So that's the, you know, that's the challenge. Okay, another great one from Dean. When do we trust a text or scripture? I love your questions. When do we trust a text as truly representing the real Jesus, and when is it a redaction error? Wow. Wouldn't it just be great if we'd say, no, 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 no. Oh, this is the truth. So what I would say about that is a couple things. First of all, you can do a lot of research. I mean, there is tremendous Bible scholarship. You can find out when things were written. You can find out more about who wrote them and what their agenda may have been, why they put these words into the mouth of Jesus. I brought this resource today. I've spoken about this before. It's called The Five Gospels, and it's the product of the Jesus Seminar, about 200 or so renowned, very accomplished Bible scholars who spent several years poring over all of the red letter sayings in the Bible, and then through much study, discussion, and eventually a vote, decided which they thought Jesus actually said, which he may have said, which sounded kind of like him, and which he absolutely did not say. So they're coded red, pink, gray, and black. So that can give you a start. That doesn't go down to the fine level of detail that you are probably interested in, and many of us are interested in. So at that point, I believe it becomes your own internal barometer, right? Does this resonate for you? You know, here, not here. Not can you create a story around that? Does it create oneness? Does it create separation? Do these ideas that you're reading, you know, if you internalize them, do they help you be a better person? Do they make you more loving, more compassionate? You know, I believe that, you know, so many people have studied the historical Jesus just trying to pin down, like, who was this guy? What did he actually say? What did he actually do? And from my reading and my study and reading about others who've studied him, to me, all you can really get is a sense of him. Right, sort of an essence of, okay, what was this guy generally like? What was he generally about? And I believe he was about shifting our consciousness so that we could love more fully. And those things, you know, what I read that supports that, I feel like, okay, that resonates for me. Does that make sense? Okay. And the Bible, as far as that goes, the Bible is a mixed bag. It truly is. When you study how the Bible was pulled together, who wrote it, when they wrote it, why they wrote it, all that stuff, you're like, oh my gosh, how do I even begin here? And so what we say in unity is take what works for you and leave the rest, which is probably what we kind of do anyway, honestly. If it makes you a more whole, loving, conscious individual, go with it. All right, this is from John Cates. I have a couple from John. Really intriguing question. The Bible refers to salt dozens of times, usually emphasizing its importance and value. Yet in Genesis, Lot's wife was turned into salt as punishment. What is the metaphysical take on salt? So for this one, I did some research. And it's actually quite fun. So in the Bible, salt is used variously to signify permanence, loyalty, durability, fidelity, usefulness, value, and purification. In a general sense, it is presented positively, like you are the salt of the earth. You have an essential aspect that adds value to this life. However, in this story that you mentioned, Lot's wife was turned into salt. That was not a positive. So this comes from Genesis 19. Many of you know it, but in case you don't, it's the story of Lot, a man named Lot, and his family, whom God was sparing before he rained hell and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah. And the angels told Lot, his wife, and their two daughters to, quote, flee for your life, don't look back or stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the hills or else you will be consumed. So Lot and his daughters followed the advice, but Lot's wife behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt, essentially a statue. So there's no special meaning. I looked really hard on this. There's no special meaning assigned to salt, only that salt formations in the Dead Sea area are kind of strikingly odd, and it's possible one of them looked kind of like a woman. But the simple metaphysical interpretation, so this is what we do in Unity, we interpret the Bible metaphysically. The simple metaphysical interpretation is, don't look back. you can't move forward if you're fixated on the past, if you're dwelling on the past with longing or regret, you are frozen in the past. The angels also said, flee to the hills, which can be seen as go up to a higher perspective. Stay focused on the power and promise of the present. And a final lesson would be, if an angel gives you directions, don't argue. So another one from John. What is the metaphysical interpretation of the Tower of Babel and its significance? So this story comes from Genesis chapter 11. The people who built the city of Babel decided that they would also build a tower with its top to the heavens and make a name for themselves. God was not pleased. When he saw the city and the tower, this is from the Old Testament, by the way. When he saw the city and the tower, he decided to confuse the language so each person spoke a different language. No one could understand each other, so they all scattered and stopped the process of building the tower. All right, so how do we interpret this? The term Babel means confusion. That sort of fits, right? The metaphysical interpretation is we all want to connect with the divine, but when we rely on our concepts, our ideas, our mental constructs, material approaches, creates confusion. Now, can you relate to this in your own life? Like, think of all the things you've been told, the things you've been read. You're trying to force these ideas. That's not where the realization comes from. The only way to really know God is through your own inner work. Additionally, our spiritual purpose is not to build a tower to a heaven up there, but to create the kingdom of heaven on earth and within us. And a final comment would be that the people were driven to make a name for themselves. They wanted to be celebrities. Look at this great tower we made. Their intention was ego-driven. The lesson is that the foundations for our work and our lives must be spiritual versus material. Isn't that interesting? Thanks for that question. Okay, I got one more from John, and then one quick question after that. Scientists believe the universe, this is a nice light question. Scientists believe the universe is about 13.6 billion years old and was created by a Big Bang. During these billions of years of evolution, did God, or more appropriately, Creator, also evolve? Such as creating dinosaurs, etc., but realizing that wasn't working, so trying something else. Just using the Bible as a reference, there has been spiritual evolution, the creation of heaven and earth, Adam and Eve, giving humankind the ability of choice and decision-making, the first one being eating from the tree of knowledge, vengefulness, etc., and subsequently the teachings of Jesus. So, there's a couple aspects to this question. So you're really asking, is the creator or the creative force evolving? So one way of thinking of it is if we say that God is the ground of all being, that everything is of God, that we are in our essence of spirit, then as we evolve, then obviously God is evolving also, right? The creation is the creator, and as the creation evolves, the creator is evolving because that's what the creator is. I think it's a little different perhaps than what you were saying, or at least what came to mind for me was this isn't a matter of, you know, like the Wizard of Oz up there behind the curtain saying, I think I'll try dinosaurs, or no, that's a bad idea, let's try this, let's try that, which, you know, I know that's not what you really meant, but some people do believe that. But it isn't about a super being, you know, using a mind and trying this and trying that. It's more the evolution toward a more complex and higher order of things. So there are a lot of philosophers who support the idea that God is always evolving, including German philosopher George Hegel, who wrote in the 18th century, everything that from eternity has happened in heaven and earth, the life of God and all the deeds of time simply are the struggles for spirit to know itself, to find itself before itself, and finally unite itself to itself. That's kind of cool, right? He said, the objective of world history is for spirit to know itself as encompassing all reality. Other philosophers such as Sri Aurobindo, Pierre Thierry de Chardin, and Alfred North Whitehead agree with this philosophy. And the only thing I would say as kind of a postscript to that is, you know, in unity we teach that God is principle. And so for me personally, I believe that the expression of God is always evolving, and the specific components, but the principle of God, at least for me, is unchanging. And by that I mean, if the principle of God is toward a constantly higher good, or evolution into greater complexity or movement toward greater oneness, then that principle, that way, if you will, that way, that wayness that is embedded in all things, to me that is continual as is. And my last question is from Lorena Griffin, and this is a little different note. Why is it that upon retirement you have to cut all ties with Unity and the congregation? Are you not even allowed to come as another congregant? Like I said, a broad range of questions. I'm really glad you asked this one, because this one has been coming up in the small groups that I've been having. So here's the thing. When I leave here, a new transitional minister will come in. And after that transitional minister, you'll have a new senior minister. And that person, those people, both, deserve to have the opportunity to have somewhat of a clean slate in creating their relationships with you, in serving this community, in being exactly who they are, rather than me still popping up and staying connected with folks and sort of diverting attention toward me or our relationship, when it really belongs to the future of Unity Renaissance as represented by these folks coming in. I absolutely honor that. I believe in that. I'm okay with that, even though, you know, it's not easy on a personal, emotional level. But I know if when I came here as the minister, if Laura Bennett, the previous minister, had been sitting here, or people had been going to her for ministerial counseling or whatever, it would have been like, hey, wait a minute, you know, I'm trying to create my relationships here. But the thing I want you to remember is this isn't forever, right? This is just until the new senior minister gets established. And I need to go off and rest for a while and kind of rediscover who I am. So my rule of thumb is maybe a year or so after the new senior minister is here, then I'll be able to get permission to come back, because I absolutely want that with all my heart. This is the only church I want to go to. This is the only community I'm interested in being a part of. And we're going to be here. And it's important to me to take part in helping to create what we can create here, but in a new way, so I can still be here as a congregant and a volunteer. So those things are important to me. So just, you know this. It's not an easy thing, but it's so right. It's so right for the new person, people coming in, and it's ultimately really right for you. So I come from, how am I going to do this when I'm grieving and leaving and that kind of thing? I'm doing it from love. It's my love for Unity Renaissance and all of you. If that means I need to stay away, then I can do that. So that's it for today's questions, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Hey, just two quick notes. I forgot to mention this in my talk, but particularly for John Cates, for others who are interested in metaphysical interpretations, there is a feature on the unity.org website. I started it when I was there. You can get a metaphysical Bible interpretation. I'm going to put that slide up, Sandy, if you would. If you go to unity.org/search/Bible interpretations, and they have now created a search function. You can't see it all that well, but you put in the title or keyword, and then if you have one, or just the book, you know, Genesis or whatever it is, the chapter and the verse. And it doesn't have every single verse in the Bible in there, but it has a lot of the ones you hear the most about. I was able to look up the two that I interpreted for you today. And you may not love every single thing that you read there, but it'll make you think, that's for sure. So I just wanted to let you know to take advantage of that. I also want to say the answers today were my answers. They're not the answers, right? So take what is useful to you. And my final thought is, you know, if you want to do this sort of thing going forward, I think it's really great fun. I appreciate your questions. You have two other Unity ministers here, Reverend Richard and Reverend Ann. And if during the interim you decide you want to have an Ask the Ministers Sunday, you could certainly do that with them too. So anyway, thank you to my questioners, and thanks to all of you. So.